Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and goes out at noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Maurice Kirk, the flying vet, is back with his Piper Cub. He's now got his licence back. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Maurice Kirk. Hi, Maurice. Welcome back.
Thank you. Lovely to be back in Bristol again.
Now, you've got your flying licence back. I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing. I hope you haven't been flying underneath the Severn Bridge since you got it back.
No. Temptation. I did fly past Filton late in the evening last week, looking for a farmer's field to leave the aircraft in.
Did you ask the farmer first?
Oh, yes. It had been pre-arranged, but I hadn't been there for a very long time.
But hang on a minute, because I thought you could only actually land at airfields. You can't just pick a farmer's field and land there.
You're delving into private civil law about trespass, a subject which I would not want to express on the airwaves. But this was pre-arranged. It's just that I hadn't been there for a long, long time and forgotten in the dimpsey where the field was. But what I wanted to tell you was that, remember, you first had me on this programme 2 or 3 years ago about the closure of Filton and how I had learnt to fly with the RAF Reserve and watched the whole concept of Concorde being designed and developed with the Vulcan bombers. And I flew low, legally low, over Filton and thought, now there is the perfect spot to start my flight to Cape Town, parked under the wing of 00, whichever one it is. I don't think it's 002. It might be 002, Concorde. But it would make a very good farewell for Morris for my flight down through Africa.
So you've had a bit of a delay to your trip to South Africa. I mean, surely in your Piper Cub, it should take a few weeks. Tell us a bit about the aeroplane. What is it that you so love about the Cub?
Well, she is a wartime aircraft. She was built in 1943. You may remember that I have four Piper Cubs, three English registered Piper Cubs, G. Kirk, G. Kirk, and G. Kirk, K-I-R-K, which went to Australia and crashed in Japan and was then rebuilt in America.
So are they all flying, these four?
Well, that one is lying at the bottom, alas, of the Caribbean after a donkey stop.
Well, you couldn't really say you have it, can you, when it's at the bottom of the Caribbean?
Well, all right, then. Well, I parked it there. I did try and get a message to President Bush that there was a big oil slick there and then it might be a good place to search for oil.
Okay,
and
so there's one at the bottom of the Caribbean.
Yes.
There's one parked outside Bristol.
There's one parked outside. That's K-U-R-K. And K-E-R-K is in a lot of pieces. And I'm looking for a group of enthusiastic ladies and gentlemen who would like to help fly that aircraft to Cape Town with the gaggle of vintage aircraft that are setting off from Crete on the 9th of January. As a whole group of about 40 vintage aircraft, biplanes and so on, for Cape Town.
So where is the Piper Cub that's in pieces then?
That is mainly down in Hampshire. I have the engine, which I want to use in a shed in Taunton, which is the engine that got me to Australia, and it will need a lot of work. I hope to throw money at her. And I hope her to be ready, if only I can find a group of people who can would like to fly. This is what they did to Australia. A lot of people didn't have time to spend a whole month away from work.
But isn't it best to just put it up for sale, the bits, and someone will buy it to restore it?
Well, I'm being pushed because I am short of of the Reddys at the moment.
Right, well, you know, you're probably not going to be able to restore it yourself then, are you?
Oh, I haven't got time. Singly, it needs a group of people and some licensed engineers who have the time, because to put her together, she's a very simple aircraft. And, of course, she's multipurpose. You can land her on the beaches, you can land her in the jungle.
Oh, they're lovely airplanes,
and,
aren't they?
They fly so slowly. They're quite expensive to run now, due to the fuel. Since I've went to Australia,
is it petrol?
It's petrol. It's Mogas. It's the lowest grade petrol. It's a compression ratio of about 7 to 1.
So, it might sound like a total wild card question, but do you get any aircraft that run on diesel?
They've now converted to diesel in the last 10 years. And in fact, when I was flying to Australia with the air race, The great tanker of fuel, aviation fuel, had to be moved from Mumbai to Calcutta in order to feed the 52 aeroplanes. And it got purloined by the gentlemen who were employed to deliver. So I got up at 4 a.m, went down to a petrol station in Calcutta with a lot of plastic cans, and managed to get airborne 4.5 hours ahead of the race. And of course, it was an Australian organised race, and there was going to be a band and the president and everybody else in Burma, in whatever they call Burma now, capital.
Myanmar.
And of course, here was this scruffiest, oldest, slowest, well, that's the pilot, and also the aeroplane, was likely to get there first. And they were having kittens. Fortunately, the pump that I was using for pumping fuel from the cockpit into the engine with a tube jammed, and I had to turn sharp left and landed in the jungle in Burma, where I was for several hours trying to get fuel and persuasion to cut down some undergrowth to let me get out again. So, in fact, I did come in last again, so that was all right.
Now, we've talked about 3 of your 4 Piper Cubs. What about the last one?
Well, the fourth one is sitting in West Wales on a trailer, and she's French. She's one of the last French girls I took from France. And I've got floats for her, and I'm also looking for a group of people that just simply needs the wings put on and the floats put on. And then we've got a French Piper Cub, but it needs to be transferred to English registration, and it's easier to put it onto Irish registration. So the Irish boys are screaming for me to send it across from Fishguard to Wexford. It's finding the time in the day to do all these things.
Well, I mean, you know, surely the best thing to do is just to sell them, then someone else is responsible for it.
I'm in love with crazy old aeroplanes. It's.
I mean, you can't expect someone else to do it up for you and then fly around.
Well, I would like my children and my grandchildren to keep these aircraft.
Are they interested? Have they learned to fly?
Well, yes, one of them. Casper's gained a licence, but I was hoping that my daughters would follow. And Alex, who's hitchhiking around... He's a taunt. He's a Bristol schoolboy as well. He is now hiking around the Philippines, and all he has got surrounding him are big motorbikes, skin diving, and lots of pretty girls, and he's just enjoying life. I don't know where he gets it from.
Part of that is having your own Piper Cub that you can take the ladies up for a pleasure flight in and impress them. It's a bit better than a shiny red sports car, which is what the youngsters traditionally seem to try and impress the girls with.
What I'm preparing for at the moment is to get the radio working, because it's not been working.
But is there actually an airstrip on Lundy?
A sort of airstrip, yes.
Is it a field? Don't tell me it's a field.
It's just a rough field, and they've now filled in the potholes. I remember 20, 30 years ago, it was an extremely rough field to land on. But almost as rough as the one I landed on this Saturday just gone by in West Wales.
So what were you up to in West Wales?
Well, I have a small film crew hoping to film the aircraft in idyllic surroundings before she goes to France, where I'm going to be kirkifying her. She needs to be modified or kirkified for long-distance flights such as Australia.
Well, what you really mean is to have a whole load of fuel tanks in the cabin instead of people, isn't it?
That's right. And also blind flying equipment, so that if in very bad weather, over the Atlas Mountains or down there in the Congo in fog or mist, I'm able to keep going.
Can you sleep while you're flying this thing, you know, along with an autopilot? No. Or you need to stay awake?
Well, when I was flying to Australia, because we put the wings on so in such a hurry at Haverford West, they were on a little crooked, which meant that when you flew, the controls were a little cross-controlled.
Can't you trim?
Not if the wing is not in line with the other wing. And it's adapted, remember, for the torque of the engine and the wind of the propeller twisting around the tail. So it's all very delicately designed so that when you take your hands off, it flies in a straight line. So what I had, a big rubber bungee, like you have at fates sometimes to keep the people back, to keep it centralized, because I flew for 8 or 9 hours at a time, or 10 and a half hours. And when I got really tired over Central Australia, where my brain had said, I've done the race, I was trying to beat Amy Johnson's distance speed to Darwin. And when I got there, my brain told me I'd finished the race, but we still had another 1,000 or 2,000 miles to do. So I kept falling asleep. So I undid the rubber band so that it would twist to the left, so that I was concentrating. So if I nodded off to sleep, it would spin into a dive.
That should wake you up, shouldn't it?
Yes, well, it did. It did wake me up, and it saved my life.
Look, Maurice, I hate to be a bore, but if you're feeling really tired and you can't fly anymore, you should put the thing down.
Yes, but when you're doing these long distances, there isn't necessarily over the desert. You see, the most dangerous thing is that if you do land somewhere, you must know you can fly out again. This is important. But I was...
I mean, surely if you're landing on a bit of desert, it's not too difficult to fly out of
that. Well, no, the desert can be extremely soft.
Yeah,
what you do is, like on the beach in Java on the way to Bali, when I was very low on fuel, I had to land on a desert island beach. Well, not desert island, it was Java. But what you do is you fly down and you bounce it along the sand and then fly off and have a look at what effect you did to the sand to establish whether it's too soft for you to land without pecking the deck. That means turning over, and also to be able to take off again, because if the sand is too soft, you need an awful lot of runway, and sometimes you had to take off the length of the beach at the sea. That is to say, you'd had to wait for the low tide and fly between high tide mark and low tide mark due to the strong winds that were affecting you. All sorts of, you know, permutations. But I want to get back to what happened in West Wales this weekend. This weekend I had a rendezvous with a small film crew who were hoping to put together some good quality film of the aircraft, the Piper Cub.
So who's the film crew?
Well, I think that's without their permission. I have to keep fairly confidential about that. But they're getting together footage about the conditions of me in Wales and the South Wales Police.
Oh, I see.
And so it was rather comical that that there they were with the rendezvous, and I landed at Talbeni Airfield, which is, if you look on the map, is way past Milford Haven, and was a famous Wellington bomber Coastal Command unit during the war for bombing, for example, U-boats. I had to land for a different reason than the film crew, because the film crew were up near Solva, which is the famous poetic spot, you know, further north. But I was soon surrounded by fire engines, even though I had immediately phoned to say there is no need to come out. But then the lovely local Bobby came, who was a lovely chap, whose name I better not give. But then once my date of birth, 12345, and my full name was given to the police officer, and I showed him my passport before he asked for it, which impressed him, there was earpiece into his ear, and from then onwards I couldn't hear what he was talking about. And half of Haverford West and West Pembrokeshire were gathering to see what was going on. And suddenly police arrived, armed police, sidearms, the paddy wagon. I thought, we're ready for an arrest here.
So hang on, is this, were the film crew filming all this?
No, they weren't there.
Oh, that's
they
a pity. That's a pity, wouldn't it, isn't it? It's a lot of pity.
It's a great shame. But on my website, somebody was taking photographs of the armed police, and they're up on my website, kirkflyingvet.com. And they let it slip. I find that if I keep getting stopped by police in South Wales, I tend to finish up interrogating them. I think it's a bit impolite, but I find that it often shortens the period of inconvenience if I take control of a conversation. And one of them let it slip. They said, we question whether you are fit to fly, Mr. Kirk. I said, well, you're speaking volumes. Because, of course, the South Wales Police had put them up to this. Because it's the South Wales Police that had prevented me from flying for many years. And I've just beaten them, and the CAA have accepted that I do not have irreversible brain damage, which is what, of course, they did say to the Judge Bidder on the 1st of December 2009.
So what was the upshot? Did the armed police let you go?
They strip searched me almost.
What were they looking for?
Well, they're doing their job. You remember, Tony, I'm very right wing. People seem tend to forget that. And they were just doing a proper Anti-Terrorism Act investigation. They were given a bum steer, to use an Irish expression, to say that this man is dangerous, this man is trouble, and he is not fit to fly an aeroplane.
So this is partly, beefing up your case against South Wales Police.
Oh, it's just one more. I mean, in Brittany, in my little village, where I'm trying to retire and write you a book for you, so that you can, more than one type of book. I was arrested. I was not detained in custody by the French police, and the Welsh boy with me said he heard them mention Hôpital Psychiatrique, psychiatric hospital, and the South Wales police had put them up to that. And
so when are you actually going to make it to South Africa?
Well, now that I've had someone steal £20,000 from me and the police are dragging their feet doing anything about it, and I'm having a quite an experience in your local county court here, your brand new building, because I'm pursuing the gentleman both via the police and through the county court system, because we have evidence that he still has the money and he's admitted taking it. So I'm sort of getting into Bristol now, learning all about
So when are you going to make it to South Africa?
When I have the money to pay for the preparation of the aircraft, yes, that's it. Then I'm going.
Okay, well, anyway, hopefully we'll be able to chat to you again, Maurice, before you disappear off to the other end of the world in your Piper Cubs, or one of them, or bits from one and bits of another. Thanks very much for joining us again on Dialect.
Lovely. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Well, the Child Sexual Abuse Inquiry is finally, about a year after it was originally conceived last summer by the Home Secretary Theresa May, apparently starting to get going. I'm joined on the line by Jenny Tomlin from Reflections UK. Jenny, what is Reflections UK and how is it connected with the inquiry?
Reflections UK has decided to set up a liaison team between survivors and the CSA inquiry, basically because there's lots of issues that have yet to be raised. There's still lots of questions over the CSA. And people's voices are not being heard as they should be. And so, as a group, we want to be able to champion the voices of survivors and actually try to advise the CSA of the best way to move forward.
Now, who's now in charge of it, and do you think it's the right person in the post?
Well, I've met Judge Lowell Goddard, and I liked her very much. However, the panel that's actually running with them at the moment is not the original panel. And I was very unhappy to see the original panel, or some of the members, dismissed and a new panel formed.
Now, hang on, because, I mean, Judge Goddard is the third choice so far.
Well, she's the third chair. We never really got involved with the chair as such. I mean, they came and went so quickly. We had very little choice there. But the actual panel itself consisted of survivors, which have now been dismissed. They don't deem it necessary that survivors should be on that panel.
Well, what do you think about that?
That we strongly disagree with.
Well, that doesn't sound very good, does it? And if survivors were on that panel beforehand and they're not now, I mean, surely that's actually a step backwards.
Well, it depends which way you look at it, because what they tried to do was they tried to placate us with the knowledge that the VSCP, which is Victim Survivors Consultative Panel, would be set up and that they would liaise between survivors and the actual CSA Inquiry fully fledged panel members. Unfortunately, the VSCP, we consider, are not fit for purpose. And they've been asking for transparency throughout this inquiry, and yet the people they've elected to the VSCP, we have no knowledge of who they are, where they've come from, how they got elected. So their transparency policy, I'm afraid, is down the toilet.
Well, it doesn't sound good, does it? I mean, let's look at Hillsborough. There are many, many inquiries we can look at, including things like the Hutton report into the death of Dr. David Kelly in 2003 in the run-up to the Iraq War. We could also look at the Chilcot inquiry, which Tony Blair somehow has managed to stop coming out for many years. Many of these inquiries are fraught with problems and seem more to do with cover-up than exposing the truth. Is there anything that you think that you at Reflections UK can learn from Hillsborough about how to have an inquiry so that this stuff actually finally gets dealt with and it's not just kicking it into the long grass for another 10 years?
Well, I think we need to learn by previous mistakes when it comes to inquiries. I'm not 100% okay with certain areas, and there's certain parts of inquiries that I don't fully understand. So therefore, Reflections is set up, and the panel that we have on board have got experience of these previous inquiries and how we can move forward. So it's not just a question of just myself and one or two others getting together. This is a panel not only of survivors, but of also experts and professionals as well. So we're going to be calling on their knowledge an awful lot to help us through the procedures.
Now, I know you've had an important get-together, haven't you, over the last few days. Can you tell us whereabouts that was and how
it went?
Well,
we had our very first meeting in Loughborough near Leicester. And we held our first meeting there, and we were really privileged to have some MPs present, some GPs. We had an MBE guest speaker, and of course, lots of survivors as well.
So, I mean, what did it achieve? What did the weekend achieve?
What the weekend really achieved was the unity of the survivors to get together. We had some people that came to the meeting that hadn't stepped outside their door in many years. I think that we lifted the fear factor. I think that we also joined together as a united group to move forward and to challenge the CSA and the VSCP. And so for us, it was a huge success.
Well, it certainly is a success in morale terms with people meeting up with other people, but how is this actually going to help move things forward? Because obviously the survivors want to have some influence on how the inquiry proceeds.
Well, absolutely. The problem is, Tony, is that with a lot of these things, the government, the Home Office, the Home Secretary, the CSA panel, they're not prepared to listen to individuals. They just don't, because I've been trying for nigh on a year to be heard. And so we decided that instead of just having an individual that was trying to fight for one particular cause, we'd form this group and we'd be able to cover as many issues as possible with the inquiry and be taken a lot more seriously, because obviously we've got professionals on board as well as survivors. Reflections meeting in Loughborough last Saturday was the first of many. Our next meeting is up in Liverpool. That's going to be followed by Nottingham, Colwyn Bay in North Wales, London East, the South East, the South West. So we're building momentum.
What about the fact that it seems that almost all of the exposure of the Westminster Whitehall VIP child abuse ring, or rings even, has been with those who have died? And there's been very little even exposing of the names, at the very minimum, of those who are still alive that were part of this group. And, you know, over the last few weeks, it's been again in the press to remind us that this is not just about sexual abuse of children, it's also about murder.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we've been to Parliament, we've lobbied outside Parliament, we've actually laid flowers and pictures of loved ones that are no longer with us.
Surely, you know, it's not a lot of point in asking the establishment to do things for you. Surely the whole point of Reflections is to be doing things for yourself and actually making initiatives from survivors that are not coming from the government.
Well, absolutely, and we're going to cover those aspects as well. I mean, we're not the enemy here. We're here to support those survivors and to give them the closure that they need. Unfortunately, what happens is some people can't get even to see their MPs, and I'm one of those people. I wanted to go and see John Bercow, who's my MP, Speaker of the House, and I've been told that my issues are not urgent enough. And this is where we have to continue this fight. We need to look at all areas where people have lost loved ones, have been abused, their stories have not been told. And there are so many different organisations that need to be held accountable.
There certainly are. I mean, one of the things you could do, Jenny, is we'll be quite happy if there are people part of your group that want to make their thoughts felt and known a bit more widely. You know, send them in our direction. We'd certainly be happy to talk to them here on this show. And also, can you just let us know whereabouts or how people can get in touch with Reflections UK? Is it either online or on the phone?
Well, we've got Twitter accounts that are running at the moment. I mean, since our meeting on Saturday, we've been absolutely... it's been unprecedented, the amount of support that we've received. But yes, you can contact us. My Twitter is at Tom Lynn Jenny. And I would like to say as well that the three co-founders of Reflections, which is myself, Esther Baker, which is currently who's currently very much in the news at the moment. She's doing a big expose on the people and the paedophile ring that continuously abused her as a child. I can't say much more about that because police investigations are still going on. But yes, you can contact us at reflect_now_UK.
Okay, Jenny Tomlin, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Anytime. Thank you very much, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
My name's Angela Balassi, and I will be speaking to John Potash about his book, Drugs as Weapons Against Us. Hello, John. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Angela.
Firstly, could you tell me a little bit about the book?
Sure. The book, Drugs as Weapons Against Us, is about the targeting of society with drugs and using drugs as a tool for imperialism, and particularly the targeting of musicians to promote drugs to the masses, but also the targeting of political musicians to hurt their minds. And when these musicians started sobering up and getting more into activism, the doing away with these musicians.
Okay, and what's your background? Why did this strike a chord with you?
Well, I started working as a drug and alcohol counselor right after college, and then got a master's in counseling, and I've been doing both mental health counseling and addictions counseling for over 25 years. I've also been writing and researching and doing activist work for, you know, most of those 25 years. And first written a book called The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders before writing this book.
Okay, and why do you think people do become addicted to drugs?
Well, I think the leading research says that there's a genetic predisposition to become addicted to drugs, and the evidence seems to support that there's a predilection also just even to like drugs too much to abuse them, and that's a much larger percentage of the population than the fully addicted population. But there's also the access to drugs, which leads people to abuse drugs, and that's where U.S. intelligence really comes in by spreading them, you know, out so much throughout the world.
How do they spread them out across the world then?
Well, for example, it's been found, I found the evidence that U.S. intelligence was the largest LSD trafficker in the world in the 60s and the 1970s. In the 1970s, for example, Ronald Stark was caught in Italy and arrested with mass quantities of LSD, and it was found by an Italian governmental commission that he had LSD laboratories on several continents and that he had been working for the American Secret Services since 1960. And that's just one example of their networks. Another example is their use of Air America and other airlines to traffic opium. The CIA station chief named John Stockwell talked to me at a conference in 1990 and told me he was personally flying CIA planes with opium and heroin from the Golden Triangle area around Vietnam, and saying that part of the reason for the Vietnam War was really about controlling the opium fields, the poppy fields around the Golden Triangle area around Vietnam. And he then said in public speeches and said to me that they then switched to the Golden Crescent area for growing poppy fields, which is around Afghanistan. And they increased their CIA assets over around Afghanistan. And that became the new largest area for supplying heroin around the world. And that the CIA assets were, you know, cultivating the opium for the CIA, and the CIA was then trafficking it around the world. And those are some of the ways that the U.S. intelligence is the largest trafficker in the world. Yet another way is through Operation Sunshine, having networks of Nazis, thousands of them, sent down to Latin America. And this was reported in the New York Times. They admitted that there was, you know, estimates range between 5,000 and 10,000 Nazis saved down throughout Latin America. And they actually set up the cocaine trafficking networks that eventually toppled regimes, democratically elected regimes. They had one famous one was the Bolivian cocaine coup of 1980, where Joseph Mengele was down there helping out with that. Another guy named the Butcher of Leon, Klaus Barbie, was very active in that Bolivian cocaine coup. And those networks helped get cocaine around the world, but particularly into the United States, where it kind of former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark told me was they were using those drugs to sedate and divide the masses of Americans. And he told me that in 1991 after a conference.
So as you've said, it's been a case of possibly toppling regimes. What else has it been used for? What other benefits has it brought the U.S. intelligence?
As I say, to get them into communities and to sedate and divide the masses of people, especially poor people and people in just people of color around the U.S. in general, but also in other countries, it develops drug dealing in certain communities as quick ways to make quick large money. It's been used as excuses to repress those communities, to come down and arrest so many of those people that are involved in the drug dealing trade, and to arrest anyone with possession of drugs, and cause a lot of problems, because addictions causes so many problems, not only for the individual, but their families and the neighborhoods where the addict's living.
And is it about money?
It's partly about money, but it's also, I think, even more so about social control, about controlling the masses. And keeping, you know, really targeting activists in a big way. I think it with the LSD, it was not as much about money at all. It was much more about targeting civil rights activists at first, and then also anti-war activists. And that's where Operation MKUltra really was the most powerful. The CIA started an operation called MKUltra in 1953. It had many sub-operations. It used assets such as Timothy Leary, who admitted working for the CIA, and it put a huge media spotlight on him. And him and other media assets and CIA assets around the world promoted LSD and, I argue, hurt the minds of good activists around the U.S., but also in Britain and other countries. And in the U.S., they particularly targeted groups like Students for Democratic Society, which was the largest anti-war group in our country in the 1960s. And I show evidence of how undercover agents, such as one named George Demarly, dosed the leaders of top SDS chapters, such as the Columbia Students for Democratic Society, and particularly Mark Rudd, who was the head of Students for Democratic Society in Columbia. And when they dosed them at a party, after they first said they were anti-LSD, they thought it was anti-revolutionary. After they were dosed, they said, well, maybe it's not so bad after all. But then they started, their behavior got very erratic. Mark Rudd's behavior got very erratic. And a number of SDS leaders' behavior got erratic to the point of some of them lauded Charles Manson and his followers who murdered people in Los Angeles.
And what's the connection with Tavistock?
Well, Tavistock was running similar operations as MKUltra. And they were doing similar work in Britain and in aiding those operations with MI6 in Britain. And they allowed MKUltra Assistant Deputy Director, Robert Lashbrook, came over to London in 1965 with large amounts of money and grants for a number of different British agencies. But he also had a number of agents with him who were supposed to put acid in as many musicians' hands as possible. And this is according to A.E. Hotchner, who was Ernest Hemingway's longtime editor, in his book Blown Away about the Rolling Stones. So I show how they particularly targeted John Lennon this way, in the fact that the first person to give John Lennon acid dosed his coffee, you know, gave it to him involuntarily. And when John Lennon heard he had been dosed with acid, he was screaming mad. And George Harrison said, you know, what's acid? What's LSD? He didn't even know what LSD was at that time in 1965. And an undercover FBI agent named Schneiderman, who changed his name to Jove, named Dave Schneiderman, according to the Daily Mail, gave Mick Jagger his first of acid in 1967.
And what was the purpose of that?
Well, that was to both hurt the minds of Lennon and Jagger when they were very anti-Vietnam War, but also to manipulate them to promote LSD to the masses. And that's what ended up happening. And also, you know, with Jagger, they ended up arresting him after that and put him under legal authority's thumb. They also did the same thing with Lennon. They threatened to revoke his visa when he started getting more into the activism. And they had, you know, just a number of different reasons for doing it, but manipulating them was a top reason.
Is there anything that can be done to tackle this?
Yeah, I think that the key thing is just to avoid these drugs, enjoy the sex and rock and roll without the drugs. You know, there's a cliche in our country, I don't know if it's in your country, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And you can enjoy the other two without the drugs and not let it mess up your mind. But I think just in general, teach everyone that, you know, drugs is a kind of cultivated trend, a manipulated trend. It's not necessarily a natural phenomenon. And so we can resist that, and we can resist these trends.
And could you tell me about the Operation Mockingbird, please?
Yeah, Operation Mockingbird was a CIA operation to control the media. And they, you know, the CIA had just huge amounts of money to buy up a lot of the media. But they also had been started by the top oligarchs, the wealthiest families in our country, the J.P. Morgans, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, And those interests in the early 1900s that bought up most of the major newspapers in our country, with Operation Mockingbird, they bought up even more magazines and every other, you know, other media assets. And according to Carl Bernstein, the Watergate muckraker, he wrote an article about the Senate Church Committee, U.S. Senate Church Committee's findings in 1976, that well over 400 members of the media lived dual lives in their work for the CIA. And we're not just talking about regular journalists, we're talking about the owners of the media, along with their editors and, of course, you know, collaborating journalists. So that's part of the way that they control the media and our information, and part of the way they can manipulate society by, you know, and to create trends such as the trend for using drugs and, you know, promoting LSD and promoting ecstasy and drugs like that, and pretending like they're part of the counterculture or the left or the anti-war movement. So that's the importance of Operation Mockingbird.
Okay, and where do they get the money to buy up this media?
Well, the CIA somehow gets huge amounts of money, partly from public, taxes, but they also seem to get monies from the Rockefellers, who were the wealthiest, you know, American families of all time, and just different of those other oligarchs who made huge amounts of money, partly originally from the opium shipping trade from way back when. I get into that in my first chapter. But J.P. Morgan family also, you know, is given money to help with these, what they call black operations.
Okay. And where can we find out more about your book?
You can find out more about it at johnpotash.com, johnpotash.com, or Amazon or Barnes & Noble. In the United States, I don't know if you have it in Britain, Books A Million's a big book chain. But those are some of the places.
Well, thank you, John.
You're welcome. Thanks for talking to me, Angela.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, it's Tony Gosling here, back again, and I'm joined by Angela Balassi to go through some of the news stories over the last few weeks. Angela, we're starting, aren't we, with one of the local papers, and a look at something going on in Bristol, a massive security bill, £180,000. Now, what's this for?
That's right. North Somerset Council will spend around that amount on security measures to protect its section of the South Bristol Link Road.
Now, whereabouts roughly is this?
Well, that's just their section, parts of it along the Long Ashton bypass. And it said that this link road will improve transport links and encourage more employers to relocate to the area.
Well,
and
of course, we've got the ring road, which is around Syston, around the east of the city, that runs down to the A4, just outside Brislington. But, of course, the idea is to sort of try and link this in with the west of the city so that traffic can pass round the south of Bristol. So anyway, so what? Why £180,000 just on security? What is the problem?
Well, they say it becomes after the Metrobus protests, and they said they didn't want to have the risk facing a £1 million bill, which is what the Bristol City Council was left with.
So is there a protest over this? Is it going through some sensitive sites, I'm guessing?
Well, that's it. They've already cut trees along the route to prevent sit-ins, but they say there's no direct threat of action. But there have been sightings of people in the wood area.
Well, people do go for a walk in the woods, don't they? So what they've done this time, I suppose, is they've been thinking, well, hang on a minute, we don't want people getting up into the trees, so we'll cut the trees down before they get a chance.
It would appear so. And that's the comment from North Somerset Council Executive Member for Highways, Alphen Aprys.
So have we got good value for money, do you think?
Well, apparently this section of the road will be, well, in total it will be £45 million. So I suppose they would argue that if there's disruption or it can't go ahead, then it would cost them more in the long run.
No, effectively will mean that Bristol's surrounded by like a sort of little mini M25, won't it?
It would appear so, and they're saying it will bring relief to communities, including Barrow Gurney, which sees hundreds of vehicles a day, many travelling to Bristol Airport.
Well, you know what a lot of the transport campaigners say is they say actually building nice new roads like this just attracts more traffic.
and cutting down trees as well. I suppose some people would argue that's not the way forward if you want to keep it a green city.
No, okay, but so I suppose we have to bear this in mind when we're using this new road, if it ever gets built. I mean, I do get a bit cynical about these things. For example, I'm not sure, are they going to actually going to be electrifying the railway line from Paddington to Bristol? It looks as if there may be serious questions over that, even though it's been announced over the last 5-6 years as big fanfares and everything. Are they ever going to do it?
It remains to be seen.
It does, doesn't it? It looks like they may have run out of money anyway. Also, staying with the transport thing, car park charges. Now, where is it that's this place where we've got such high charges here in Bristol?
Well, it's reported in the Bristol Post that hospital car parks, the BRI, is one of the nation's most expensive. And they say that hospitals are charging 70% more on average for parking than the nearest local car parks.
What, 70%?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a money-making concern, I suppose, because some people may be using the BRI car park and then, rather than going to visit someone in hospital, just strolling in to do some shopping.
Well, that's certainly one argument. But also they're issuing plenty of parking tickets for visitors and patients who overstay. They say that the cost on average is £19.31 per day, compared to £8.65 for the equivalent parking nearby. Some people would argue, though, that it's not just about the cost, it's also about availability. So they seem to be running out of space, which becomes quite stressful for people who need to go to hospital.
Well, if they want to visit somebody, it must be awful if you're getting, you know, say towards the end of visiting time, you turn up to see your loved one and actually can't find anywhere to put your car. Maybe that's simple demand and supply. It's because they've just put these charges up because they can, and people will pay it.
Well, quite possibly, and I suppose some people say, you know, NHS is free, so they, you know, have, well, you're probably going to differ with me here, but it's a way of making money elsewhere.
Also, of course, worth remembering that both of the big NHS trusts we've got in Bristol, the hospital trusts anyway, that's the North Bristol Trust and the BRI, which is United Hospitals Bristol NHS Trust, are both chaired by merchant venturers who are not averse to making a bob or two out of their enterprises. I mean, it does look as if, doesn't it, that these are the perfect people to shepherd the National Health Service away from the idea that this is provided as a service to the public, and that it makes it into something which is purely for profit. I mean, ultimately, in a few years' time, there maybe could be no NHS, and I don't think the merchant venturers would necessarily mind about that.
Well, I think it would be a great pity if we were to lose it. You know, obviously benefits plenty of people. It means that there's access to healthcare for everybody.
Well, I would suggest anyone that's annoyed with the car parking charges at the BRI or anything to do with the way it's been slowly privatised, write a letter to John Savage, former master of the merchant venturers, who's the chairman of United Hospitals Bristol NHS Trust. And if you happen to be passing or you find a ticket on your car, you can just go around the corner, because right, if you come out of the BRI and turn left, you'll find Trust headquarters right there. And you never know, John Savage might be in. Angela, thanks for those stories. We've got another one though, haven't we? And this is rather more serious. It's just very recent, and it's in something called the Press Gazette. Now, the Press Gazette is something that journalists like us read more than, I suppose, most people. It's kind of in-house trade magazine, which is why I think it's particularly significant that the Jimmy Savile story is being talked about a lot amongst journalists. This story is by Marion Jones, who used to work for Panorama at the BBC. Of course, famously, Peter Rippon, who was the Panorama editor, actually cancelled the expose, which was the biggest story of the year, some would say the biggest of the decade, of Jimmy Savile, saying, well, we can't show that on the telly, we've got a Jimmy Savile special coming up at Christmas. So what are your thoughts about the way that the London media, the big multimedia media, the mainstream media, deal with these massive scoops? Because sometimes it seems that they almost hit a glass ceiling. They don't actually get broadcast, as happened with Savile. Eventually it got out, but the BBC, it seems, did everything they could to stop it.
Well, it's difficult for an individual journalist to, the you know, going against the tide, and also there are legal issues. So even though they may be aware of problems going on, of abuse going on, unless it's been recognised in the courts, it's very tricky to report.
Well, of course, this is one of the reasons why much of the scandal of the VIP defile ring has come out only about people who are dead, because their lawyers will say, well, you can't say anything about X, Y and Z because they're still alive and they might sue us.
That's it. It's often a case of wait until they die and then suddenly it all comes out of the woodwork.
But the trouble is, of course, with that is that there isn't any actual prosecution. The person then is walking the streets and gets away with it. Anyway, this story, the headline is Marion Jones. That's the chap I was just talking about from the BBC Panorama series and from News, the chief investigative reporter on Newsnight. Everyone on the right side of the Savile argument has been forced out of the BBC, he says, which is really worrying, isn't it? Because obviously there are two sides to it. One of the side is, well, the BBC needs to protect itself, protect its employees, and protect people the government wants it to. And there's another side which says we want to expose these because the police aren't dealing with it.
There is. I mean, some people say they've been pushed out. Obviously, the other side is, you know, is it just coincidence? Is it just bad, you know, bad timing? However, you know, we have seen evidence in the past that people did come forward to say that Savile, you know, was carrying out abuse, and the response at the time was, you know, police have looked into it. There's nothing else to do with it. Also, there's been more than one person who apparently has been pushed out. And it's not just that they're being pushed out. Alternatively, they've also been put into dead-end jobs. So it would seem that because of, you know, the number of people affected and the fact that maybe it hasn't been fully acknowledged in the past, that this is quite possibly still going on.
Well, Newsnight's Home Affairs editor, it was, that actually bagged the interviews with the former victims of Savile after he was dead, so there shouldn't be legal issues. And yet the BBC refused to show them. They then put the boss of Newsnight, who was discredited when the story finally came out about 8 months later, in the Oldie magazine. What happened to Liz McKean, she was the reporter, she also has been forced out and she's had to leave Newsnight. So it's not just Marion Jones. This is deadly serious stuff, folks. And if the BBC can't report on this, who can?
Well, other media publications, I mean, the BBC, which is funded by the taxpayer, often comes under fire by the Daily Mail, for example, or other mainstream media.
But the thing is, Marion Jones and various other journalists who had this story about the BBC covering up the Savile interviews and not showing them, they went around all the major newspapers in London and nobody wanted to know, apart from the Oldie magazine, this little magazine run by Richard Ingrams, who was one of the original founders of Private Eye. And now even Richard Ingrams has got the sack.
Well since this news has gone out, it has been reported in the Daily Mail just very recently. So I think it's starting to be covered now. I think possibly when, you know, a story gains momentum, gets more credibility behind it, it can gain momentum.
Well, let's hope so in the future. Anyway, thanks, Angela Balassi, very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Maurice Kirk, John Potash, Jenny Tomlin, and you heard there, Angela Balassi, also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects are Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.